It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn how Oshkosh will protect archaeological deposits from a prehistoric Native American village. The artifacts were excavated at a roadbed project in Menominee Park. That's near the shores of Lake Winnebago. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer Haas is director of the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee. Jennifer, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here this morning.
So road construction at the site started in August is being delayed due to the unearthing of these remnants of the ancient village. What can you tell us about this site?
Sure. Well, I can also just start with our work with the city of the Oshkosh for this project really went back to the beginning of the year. And we had actually planned for this. We knew that there was a very good chance that the archaeological site that has been documented in the park would extend under the roadbed. So our work really began before August earlier this year, and we did some background research, so looking at kind of what has been previously documented about this site, and then also some initial field work. And from that work and from our, you know, both the background research and the field work that we did, we looked along either side of the road. And when we did that, we found cultural items or artifacts coming out on either side of the road. So we knew kind of going in that there would be a pretty good chance that the archaeological, you know, the archaeological deposits would extend underneath the roadbed.
What sorts of cultural artifacts did you find?
For sure. That's a great question. So in our initial study that we did earlier this spring, we find artifacts or cultural items such as pottery sherds. So these are fragments of earthenware vessels, some tempered with grit or stone and some tempered with shell. That gives us clues to the age of the site. We also found stone tools and stone chips from the manufacturer of stone tools, as well as animal bone. So animal bone that had been, you know, processed for various tasks, such as, you know, certainly one for eating the, you know, animals, and also animal bone that had been shaped into tools. And then when we began the work associated with the roadbed. So when the city went in and started to work within the road, an archaeologist was on site to monitor that work and carefully watch the removal of the existing roadbed. And then what we have identified underneath the roadbed are further remnants of the archaeological site. So not only are we finding artifacts or cultural items, but we are finding what archaeologists call cultural features. And what cultural features are is a physical remnant of a past, you know, activity. So for example, a type of cultural feature would be evidence of a cooking pit or a storage pit or post holes that would indicate that there was possibly some type of structure or dwelling there. And these cultural features have, you know, distinctive, you know, characteristics. So that tells the archaeologist, you know, basically the, you know, cultural features have a different soil texture or different soil color. And that, you know, allows us to identify, you know, potentially how those features came to be. So what the past, you know, activity was that left that remnant feature as a signature in the soil.
Yes, clue by clue. Jennifer Haas with us as we talk about a preserved Native American city unearthed in Menominee Park of Oshkosh. She is the director of the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Jennifer, there are other ancient villages that exist along Lake Winnebago's shores. Can those other ancient villages give clues as to what this village was like?
Absolutely. So we know that the northwest shore of Lake Winnebago in particular, but really all along the lake shore, this was a very important location throughout the prehistory. So we know that people were living in this area, and along the northwest shore in particular, we know that between somewhere beginning in like the 1200s and 1300s, populations really kind of packed in to different villages along that northwest shore. And so there's been many of these village sites documented along that northwest shore of Lake Winnebago. And we had a recent project a couple of years ago up in the city of Neenah within their parklands up there where we found a very similar village site.
What do you hope to learn from this particular site in Menominee Park?
Oh, it's a great question. So archaeological sites are important for the information that they, contain. It's not only the artifacts that you find, but the context of those artifacts to each other and also to, cultural features. And because we're dealing with a time where there are no written records, although we do have some insight from oral histories of tribal nations, archaeology provides an important clue into understanding the, past. So part of our work that we're doing at, Menominee Park is to have a better understanding of how people lived in the past, and look at maybe why they were here and what they were doing.
These artifacts are expected to stay in the ground undisturbed. Why is that important?
Yeah, so archaeological sites, even when you carefully excavate them, you are destroying them. So in the best possible case, you want to, really, preserve in place to the greatest extent possible to keep the archaeological sites in intact and available for future research. And for the Menominee Park project in particular, we worked early on with the city of Oshkosh and also the regulatory agencies involved in the project, so the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and the Wisconsin Historical Society, and tribal nations, to come up with a plan in the event that cultural and archaeological features and deposits were identified under the roadbed. And part of that plan that we developed in consultation was to, preserve in place to the greatest extent possible any archaeological deposits identified underneath the road.
Can you walk us through a bit more of that plan? What will happen to the site after it has been studied and documented? Will it remain roped off?
No, the road will go back,
okay.
And we are carefully documenting all of our findings. So all of the cultural features that we're identifying out there are being carefully mapped and, documented. And at kind of the end of that process, we'll have a pretty comprehensive view, at least along the linear corridor of the road, of kind of how that site may have looked. And then the road bed will be built back on top of the archaeological, deposits. The city of Oshkosh will manage and maintain the site. So that's one of the nice things in this case, where the archaeological site will really stay in the public, domain. The city will have... they'll know where the site is, they'll know where the significant archaeological deposits are, and then they can effectively manage and protect the site.
Archaeologist and historian Jennifer Haas directs the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee as we discuss what happens to these cultural items and remnants from a prehistoric Native American village site in Oshkosh. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW-Milwaukee archaeologists identify evidence of a prehistoric Native American settlement found at a road construction site in Oshkosh's Menominee Park. We discuss the significance of the find and next steps for preservation. You can call in with a question or add your comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer Haas directs the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee. Jennifer, the Menominee Park area is within the Aboriginal homeland area of the Menominee and Ho-Chunk Nations. How is your department working with Native American tribes to preserve the village?
So we are actually following some of our state laws, which is how we got, you know, involved in the project to begin with a city. And our state does have fairly, you know, robust laws that protect cultural resources, of which archaeological sites are a type. And kind of part of that process, we, you know, engaged early on with tribal nations, including the Ho-Chunk Nation and the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin early on in the process. And as I mentioned earlier, part of that of those consultation efforts was to develop a plan to allow for, you know, preservation in place. Throughout the course of the project, we are working very closely with the, you know, regulatory agencies, so both the Department of Natural Resources and the Wisconsin Historical Society, as well as the tribal nations that have expressed an interest in this project, including Ho-Chunk and Menominee.
You mentioned robust state and federal laws to protect archaeological sites. What laws do you find most important?
Well, certainly those laws that kind of serve to protect cultural resources, including archaeological sites. So for the Menominee Park project here, really it was our state level laws that came into place. And those laws kind of come into play if there's any type of state action. So it could be state funding or state permitting. And in the case of the Menominee Park project, it was a state permit that was needed by the Department of Natural Resources that kind of triggered the cultural resources, you know, review required for the project. Mm-hmm. And part of that process, and our state law does protect, if there's a state action involved in a project, it protects those locations where there are known archaeological sites. So not necessarily all the archaeological sites that may exist in the state, but those that have been, you know, documented. And our Office of the State Archaeologist does maintain a database of the archaeological sites that have been documented throughout the state.
How can you ensure the site is protected from vandalism or from souvenir hunters?
Well, there again are laws that, you know, prohibit that. So it is you know, you cannot as a private citizen excavate or, you know, disturb certain classes of sites within the state of Wisconsin. So there is some you know, protection on that front.
We're talking about a preserved Native village unearthed in the Menominee Park of Oshkosh with Jennifer Haas. She's the director of the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in with your questions and your comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jennifer, we heard from Beth in Milton who called in, and Beth is wondering if archaeologists know the approximate age of the artifacts that have been discovered so far.
So thank you. That we do have a pretty good idea. So we believe that the site dates to about AD 900 to perhaps as late as 1600. And one of the ways that we know that is from the types of artifacts that we're finding, and in particular, the types of pottery or earthenware vessel fragments that we have. There are distinctive ways that the pottery was, decorated and also made that provides us clues to the time period and that those types of vessels were made.
Do those vessels have similarities to others that you've documented on the shores of Lake Winnebago?
Absolutely. So some of the earthenware vessels we know kind of date to what archaeologists call this late woodland era, which is about 900 to 1200 AD. And from the kind of archaeological point of view, the ceramics that we're seeing that date to that period were tempered with rock and, decorated with a variety of cord markings. So that was either pressed into the surface of the, vessel in different patterns. Another type of pottery or earthenware vessels that we're finding relate to what archaeologists call the Oneota, and they're a little bit later, probably 1200 to perhaps as late as 1600s. And the earthenware vessels manufactured by these people were tempered with shell. So based on the construction of the vessels, we can, as archaeologists can tell that these were two perhaps different groups of people from different time periods.
And you call evidence of past activity in the ground signatures in the soil. Can you give an example of different types of signatures in the soil?
Certainly. So they look different than the surrounding soil matrix. So these different cultural features, they're going to typically be darker in color and perhaps have a different texture. And one of the ways to kind of think about this and kind of what we look at, if you think about perhaps how a house structure was looked in the past, so if you could picture in your mind's eye a wigwam type structure with a series of poles that would have been excavated into the ground to maintain the structural integrity of the dwelling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So because that house type structure was made of organic material, there's no above the ground evidence anymore of that house structure. But what archaeologists find are the remnants of the post holes from the manufacture or the structure of the house. So we don't see the above ground evidence, but where the posts were in the ground leaves a distinctive soil stain, so it's darker. And then these smaller round holes, and we can look at the collective patterning of those soil stains or those post holes, what archaeologists would call post holes. And then that can tell us, based on the patterning, that there was probably a structure or dwelling in that location.
So you can really examine these patterns and these impressions in the soil to be able to construct what was happening there.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
Wow, that is so exciting. Very quickly here, as we're almost out of time, next steps in the coming weeks, winter is coming. What happens?
Winter is coming too soon, but we will secure the site location and the road and where we're working in the road for the winter, and then we will continue our work in the spring.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Haas is an archaeologist, historian, and director of the Archaeological Research Laboratory Center at UW-Milwaukee. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore developments in litigation the State Department of Justice is pursuing with Attorney General Josh Call, starting with Wisconsin joining dozens of states suing social media giant Meta. You can be part of the conversation at any point by asking a question or sharing your comment at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Attorney General Josh Call, welcome back to the Ideas Network. Attorney General Josh Call, can you hear us?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Yes. So you and 41 other attorneys general are accusing Meta of violating state consumer protection laws and the federal Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. Why do you think Meta misled people and allegedly concealed harm suffered by young users of its platforms like Instagram and Facebook?
Well, we've alleged that Meta has made huge profits as a result of the actions that it's taken. Meta benefits financially when people, and in particular young people, remain on its social media platforms like Instagram and Facebook for extended periods of time. And we've alleged that there are a number of features that Meta has in place that effectively keep young people hooked on its platforms. In addition to that, Meta, we've alleged, didn't want that information to get out, information about the harms that its products cause to kids, because certainly a lot of people, if they were aware of that data, would take action based on it. I think a lot of parents would be concerned about what we've alleged. And instead, Meta purported that its products were safe for kids. And we believe that companies like Meta have an obligation, and in fact, state law provides that obligation, to provide accurate information to people about the harms and benefits of products.
Looking at the coordination of this multi-state suit, how much input do you have in lawsuits like this one, in which 33 states are involved in suing Meta?
We work together with other states on a variety of different types of cases. One really prominent recent example is in cases involving the opioid epidemic, where states across the country work together to hold opioid companies accountable and to recover resources for communities in their states. Likewise here, this is a multi-state effort where representatives of AG's offices from around the country have been involved. And in any case like this, usually what happens is there's a committee that's formed to sort of lead the day-to-day effort. But each state, if it wants to, has the opportunity to provide input about the direction of things, and where there are disagreements, of course, those get worked out between the states. And then at the end of the day, deciding whether to join the suit or not is a decision that each state needs to make for itself. Given the significance of this issue and how committed we are at the Department of Justice to doing what we can to keep kids safe, the decision to join this suit was straightforward, and we believe it's critical that we hold Meta accountable for the actions that have been alleged here.
There is critique that this is rare bipartisan support in the moment for a lawsuit on both the state and federal level. How could lawmakers united in their interest to regulate big tech over protection of children be convinced to cooperate on other issues?
One of the things that I think is really remarkable about the work that AG's offices around the country do is that we actually work together in a bipartisan fashion on a number of different issues. Protecting consumers shouldn't be a partisan issue. Protecting public safety shouldn't be a partisan issue. And what we've been able to do is recognize that by working together, we can achieve better outcomes for our states. We're able to pool our resources and we're able to share thoughts on strategy as well as information that we obtain and to get better results because of that. Obviously, in politics, the partisanship has become a hindrance to making progress. And, I think looking at the example that we've seen here and in other actions, as I mentioned, the opioid cases are a good example of this. You can see the difference we can make for Wisconsinites and Americans by working collaboratively.
What guardrails would you like to see put in place to protect children from being exposed to addictive online practices?
Well, as we move forward in this case, there'll be hopefully more discussion about the potential remedies. You know, right now we've just recently filed the suit. But that being said, there are a few sort of baseline principles that are going to shape how we hope to see this resolved. I want to make sure that we are ensuring that there are protections in place to keep young people safe as they're using social media platforms. There are a lot of benefits to using social media, but recognizing what potential harms are out there and how social media can cause harms to mental health and kids' well-being is a critical part of designing appropriate solutions. It's also critical that accurate information is being provided. You know, as a parent myself, my kids are in fourth and first grade. We make all sorts of decisions about how we keep our kids safe. And we provide information to kids about how to stay safe. You know, look both ways before you cross the street, for example. Likewise, with social media, this has become a huge part of everybody's life, including the lives of young people. And ensuring that parents and young people themselves have the information that they need to make good decisions for themselves and their families is vital. And that's one of the things that we want to make sure comes out of this as well.
We're talking about recent litigation and activity with the head of the State Department of Justice, Attorney General Josh Call. You can join in with your questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jim in River Falls. Hi, Jim. What is your question?
Good morning. Thanks for having the program. I was just wondering, with the officials that submitted a slate of false electors for the 2020 elections, I know some states are pursuing criminal investigations into those people that have done that. And I'm just wondering where the state of Wisconsin is with that, because I know we had our own very own group that did that here. Seems like that was an illegal activity that should be prosecuted.
Jim, thanks for the question. Attorney General.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Jim. My view is that anybody who committed crimes with the goal of trying to overturn the results of any election needs to be held accountable. Now, we generally don't comment on investigations or potential investigations that the Wisconsin Department of Justice is conducting, but what I can say is that I fully support the ongoing federal efforts to investigate and prosecute people for conduct relating to the insurrection on January 6th. From what I have seen, the federal investigation led by Jack Smith appears to be moving swiftly and not only has resulted in charges against former President Trump, but also has led to several unidentified co-conspirators being indicted. And so I expect that we will see further action as a part of that federal investigation. Obviously the trial against President Trump will be moving forward as well. And then I think it's important to note that a couple of things. One is that evidence from federal investigations, with certain exceptions, but generally speaking, can be used in connection with state prosecutions. And so it's certainly possible that there would be evidence from the federal investigation here that's relevant to decisions that, that DAs make about charging here. But also that it's important that when there are investigations going forward, that you don't have several competing investigations into the same facts, which can undermine ongoing investigations. So those are a few things that are relevant here. But the bottom line is that anybody who committed crimes to try to overturn the results of an election should be held accountable.
Turning to the Wisconsin Elections Commission, last week, a Dane County judge temporarily blocked the removal of Megan Wolf as Wisconsin Elections Commission administrator by Republican lawmakers. What effect will keeping Wolf in that role have on statewide elections?
Well, that order is going to help us ensure that there is stability as we move forward in our election system. We are heading into a presidential election season, and having our chief election officer in the state, having it clear to everybody who that is and having stability there is going to be vital to protecting people's right to vote as we move into the election. Now, it's unfortunate that we're in this situation after the election commission chose not to appoint a new administrator. It was clear that, that state law allowed Megan Wolf to remain on as administrator. When the Senate decided it was going to potentially take action, I sent a letter to legislative counsel making clear that under state law, Megan Wolf is able to remain in that position. Legislative counsel itself put out a memo confirming that position. And despite that, the Senate took a vote purporting to remove Megan Wolf from office. So we filed suit that same day because we wanted to make sure that there was clarity. With the Senate's action, we believed created a real risk that there would be confusion about whether Megan Wolf remained empowered to act as the administrator. And in response to our suit, rather than defending the action the Senate took to attempt to remove Megan Wolf, the defendants said that the vote was symbolic and acknowledged that Megan Wolf remained as the administrator. So all of this confusion that was created was really created unnecessarily by the Senate here. Now, there's ongoing litigation. The Senate and the defendants in the case have now raised a new argument asserting that the Election Commission is obligated to appoint somebody new as administrator. And there will be litigation on that issue as we move forward. But for now, at least, we've got certainty about who is running the Election Commission, and this litigation will resolve any lingering questions relating to this issue.
Just a timeline there. GOP leaders are now asking the court to order the Elections Commission to appoint a new administrator no later than tomorrow, November 1st. What is your response?
Well, the litigation is ongoing, and certainly the court will weigh in as requests are made. But it's certainly not unusual for there to be requests made in litigation that aren't consistent with what ends up happening. But look, the legislature created a bipartisan six-member commission, and it intentionally created it with three Democratic appointees and three Republican appointees. And it's not going to be unusual for that committee to split 3-3. There was discretion given to the Election Commission to decide what actions to take. Now for the legislature to come in and say that somebody has to be appointed by a particular date is just not consistent with the way that commission was set up. So, again, we will see how things play out in litigation, but I'm confident that Megan Wolf, as now a court order has confirmed, is able to exercise her authority as the administrator, and I believe she's going to continue to be able to do that.
Attorney General Josh Call with us to talk about the latest on litigation taken up by the State Justice Department. Join in the discussion with your thoughts. You can ask a question. The number is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're in conversation with Attorney General Josh Call on a range of issues involving State Department of Justice casework. And you can field your question at any point to the Attorney General. Share what's on your mind. The number to be part of the discussion is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. This month, you filed a brief on behalf of Governor Evers asking the state Supreme Court to declare unconstitutional the state's legislative maps and institute new voting maps. What would you and the governor like to see in new district maps?
Well, very simply, we want to see fair maps in the state of Wisconsin. We believe that the maps that are in place currently are unconstitutional, and we've raised two arguments in our brief as the state Supreme Court directed as to why the maps are unconstitutional. But for years now, more than a decade, we have had maps that were designed by legislators to protect their own power and to entrench themselves in power. That's not how our system was set up to work. So we would like to see maps that empower voters and that are responsive to the vote. So if you have an election that statewide is 50-50, you expect to have a roughly even result in the legislature. What we've had instead are very lopsided legislative majorities. Likewise, if you have a year that's good for Democrats, you expect to have that reflected with more Democrats in office. And if you have a year that's good for Republicans, we expect to have more Republicans in office. So that alone is critical here. And I would add, this is part and parcel with the previous issue we were talking about, which is the attack on the administration of the Election Commission. And so many other attacks we've seen on our voting rights recently. We need to be protecting our freedom to vote and empowering voters in Wisconsin. And whether that's through fair maps or defending the fair administration of elections or expanding rather than restricting access to voting, there are a lot of steps we can be taking to empower our voters rather than to entrench politicians into office. And redistricting is a great example of that.
So the Wisconsin Supreme Court agrees to hear a legal challenge to the state's legislative maps. The court is scheduled to hear oral arguments on November 21st. How do you anticipate this case will play out?
Well, the arguments on the 21st, I think, will provide a lot of insight into what's likely going to lie ahead. As I mentioned, there are a few challenges to the constitutionality of the maps that the court is considering, and I assume the court will address those issues first. Now, if the court finds that the maps are unconstitutional, then there's going to need to be a remedy. There are going to need to be new maps adopted. We have advocated for that process to move quickly. Wisconsinites already had to vote in the 2022 elections with the maps that we believe were unconstitutional. And they shouldn't have to vote in the 2024 elections with unconstitutional maps as well. So it's my hope that the court will adopt a process, if the maps are found to be unconstitutional, that leads to new maps being put in place quickly. And the court can do that in a variety of ways. It could appoint somebody to oversee a process, or it could ask the parties to submit maps. But whatever option is taken, again, it's my hope that the process moves quickly so that voters are once again empowered to select their legislators and not the other way around.
Does the court have the power to address these maps without reopening their decision in Johnson versus Wisconsin Election Commission, the case that set our state's current electoral maps?
Well, the issues that have been raised in this case are fairly different from the issues that were raised in Johnson. And the court was adopting a map, and so it was acting sort of in an initial capacity to put maps in place. Mm-hmm. And as you may recall, initially the court actually adopted a different set of maps for the legislature. Mm-hmm. Then the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated those maps, came back, and the court, through a 4-3 vote, adopted the current maps. And Justice Hagedorn, in his opinion, a concurring opinion, basically said, you know, we've run out of time, so we're adopting this. It was almost an adoption of maps by default. But the arguments that are being raised here are different ones that weren't fully addressed or even significantly addressed in the prior case. And so it's our view that the court should take a fresh look at those issues, reassess. And I believe that when the court does that, it's going to find that these maps are constitutionally invalid.
We're talking about recent lawsuits with the head of the State Department of Justice, Attorney General Josh Call. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. This month, a Republican-controlled state Senate committee voted to spend tens of millions of dollars on PFAS remediation. What is your response to the Republican approach to addressing the issue with toxic forever chemicals?
Well, first, I'm glad that there's interest in this issue. PFAS contamination is impacting communities around the state and around the country. I have been to Northeastern Wisconsin and heard from people who've been impacted by PFAS contamination. There are a number of communities where we continue to learn about PFAS contamination as testing takes place. And it's critical that Wisconsinites have access to safe and clean drinking water. In Wisconsin, in the 21st century, that should be a no-brainer, and it shouldn't be something that folks have to worry about. They certainly shouldn't have to worry that the water that they've been drinking for decades is going to make them sick. That's why we have taken aggressive action to hold companies accountable for PFAS contamination in Wisconsin. Now, it's great that the legislature is getting involved in this, and funding to remediate this problem is really important. What I don't want to see, though, and what I'm concerned about with the proposal that's in front of us, is that the DNR's ability to remedy PFAS contamination is going to be limited. That's bad because it makes it harder to clean up PFAS contamination. But also, the companies that made huge amounts of money by producing and marketing PFAS, that's who should be paying to clean this up. Limiting their liability means shifting that responsibility onto the taxpayers. And that is the last thing I want to see, is taxpayers being required to foot the bill for PFAS contamination. So it's my hope that money will be provided without strings attached, or without allowing companies that were responsible for PFAS contamination to get away with it. I think there's more work that needs to be done before legislation should be enacted.
Meanwhile, there are residents of Peshtigo who have been living off of bottled water for nearly 6 years due to PFAS-contaminated private wells. What would you tell them?
Well, that's right. When I mentioned I was in Northeast Wisconsin, I was in Marinette, and I heard from residents in Marinette and Peshtigo and nearby. And folks there are really struggling with the situation. As I mentioned, people are worried about their health, whether the water they drank is going to cause them harm. People are worried about the ability to sell their houses, and they're worried about their kids. We need to make sure that we are taking swift action to address this issue. And again, it's why having strings attached to this legislation is problematic. We shouldn't be doing anything to slow down funding that can go to remediating this harm. We just need the legislature to move forward and provide the resources. The court system takes a long time to play out often, and the litigation efforts that we've had related to this have been ongoing now for a period of time. And ultimately, that's part of the solution. But the legislature can act promptly, and I hope that it does, so that we can get relief to people rather than doing it in a way that's going to potentially allow those responsible for pollution to evade accountability.
Attorney General Josh Call, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Josh Call is Wisconsin's 45th Attorney General and is in his second term. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.